Good evening. My name is Heike Sanguinetti, and I'm a student project manager at the CLAR Forum for Contemporary Issues. On behalf of Dickinson College and the CLAR Forum, I would like to welcome you to tonight's program, Drinking Age Debate, Legal Age 21 After 23 Years. Has it worked? Is it working? In 1984, the United States Congress passed the National Minimum Legal Drinking Age Act, which required all states to raise their minimum purchase and public possession of alcohol age to 21. Because of this law, the United States has the highest minimum drinking age in the world. This has caused extremely diverse and passionate reactions in our society, as well as intended and unintended consequences. The ongoing debate presents two extremely controversial sides. On the one hand, the advocates of the law argue that people under the age of 21 have not reached the sufficient level of maturity to drink in a moderate manner. Other arguments used include the large number of underage people involved in drunk driving accidents and the potential damage to their overall physical development. Opponents of this law have highlighted that not only is this law inefficient, but it also encourages minors to look for alternatives for alcohol consumption, such as binge drinking, thus causing many more alcohol-related health problems. Mr. McArdle and Mr. Hurley are here tonight to discuss the implications and effectiveness of this law. John McArdle is the founder and director of Choose Responsibility, a nonprofit organization which encourages consideration of policies that will empower young people ages 18 to 20 to make mature decisions regarding alcohol consumption. He did his graduate work at Johns Hopkins University and received his doctorate from Harvard University. Mr. McArdle was named president of Middlebury College in 1992. Prior to that, he served several other professorial positions. Chuck Hurley, Dickinson class of 1967, graduated with a bachelor's degree in political science. He was president of Skull and Key, an honorary society for junior men, and was also a member of the Phi Kappa Sigma fraternity. Mr. Hurley has served as the vice president of both the Public Policy and the Transportation Safety Group for the National Safety Council. He was senior vice president of the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety before becoming chief executive officer of Mothers Against Drunk Driving, also known as MAD. Mr. Hurley strongly supported and assisted in MAD's efforts to pass the Minimum Drinking Age Act in 1984. Professor Douglas Edlin, a member of the Department of Political Science at Dickinson College, will be moderating the debate tonight. We would like to thank James Chambers, Dickinson class of 1978, and wife Nisi for sponsoring this program this evening. At this time, I would like to remind you to please turn off all cell phones and pagers. Also, since this program is being taped and some of other audience members may be hearing impaired, please wait for a microphone to reach you before asking a question during the question and answer session at the end of the program. At the conclusion of tonight's program, please place the ballots that you receive upon entrance in the boxes located at the doors on your way out of the social hall. Immediately following the program this evening, there will be a continuing the debate session in HAPSCI rooms 202 and 203. This will be an informal discussion about the program, and refreshments will be provided. Now please join me welcoming John McArdle, Chuck Hurley, and Doug Edlin.
Good evening. Thank you for being here tonight. On behalf of Dickinson College and the CLAR Forum, I also would like to extend gratitude and a welcome to Professor McArdle and Mr. Hurley. And as the moderator of the debate this evening, my job, unfortunately for all of you, is to enforce the rules of the debate, which are as follows. Professor McArdle will speak for 8 minutes. He will be followed by Mr. Hurley, who will speak for 8 minutes. Professor McArdle will then have a 3-minute rebuttal period, followed by Mr. Hurley's 3-minute rebuttal period. After that time, the floor will be thrown open to questions. I want to remind you all, although it goes without saying, I'm going to say it anyway, this is an institution of higher learning, and in particular, Dickinson has a long tradition of encouraging debate and discussion about contentious issues. The debate is what we're here to hear, and I'm going to ensure that that debate takes place in the sort of respectful and dignified manner that these two gentlemen deserve and the issue demands. This is the issue of drunk driving, the issue of the legal drinking age, is something that spans really a spectrum for people's personal experience and for the arguments that we're about to listen to, from personal responsibility to personal tragedy, and from public health to individual rights. And because of the magnitude of the issues that are at stake, it's going to be important for all of you, and I'm going to ensure that you address your questions, whatever they happen to be, to Professor McArdle or Mr. Hurley in a dignified and respectful manner, as they and the debate deserve. And if any question, in my opinion, is not phrased in those terms, I will not allow either participant to answer it, and I'll make that judgment myself. Before we begin, I also want to welcome all of you here tonight. I think you're going to enjoy the debate tremendously, and I hope that some of you at least will begin to think about this issue perhaps in a way that you haven't thought about it before. So please also join me in welcoming Professor McArdle and Mr. Hurley.
I was about to take off my watch and put it on the lectern, but then I was reminded of something I heard a preacher say not too many weeks ago, which said, you know what it means when a preacher takes off his watch? Silence. Absolutely nothing. So instead, I'm going to try my best to observe the eight-minute limit, confident in our moderator to enforce that rule if I should prove too excessive in my exploitation of the generosity of this forum. But I don't think it's possible to be excessively effusive in my expression of gratitude to Dickinson College and to the Clark Forum for this invitation. This is a very serious issue. It is one that lends itself to debate, and it is one that for too long has not been allowed to be debated. And so my thanks and my gratitude to those of you here at Dickinson for permitting this to take place, and for, I hope, initiating a debate that will continue as this very important public policy question continues to be reviewed and aired in a variety of public fora. Now, the historian in me is prompted to begin with an anecdote that may or may not be germane to this discussion, but it happens to involve both my college and yours. A man by the name of Jeremiah Atwater was the very first president of Middlebury College. You are older than we. Jeremiah Atwater was the first president of our college, which was founded in 1800. And he served 9 years at the fledgling institution. As his term of office was coming to an end, the trustees of Dickinson were looking for a new chief executive, and they searched high and low, but the profile for this candidate had a very specific set of requirements, because it seems as if the students at Dickinson College's behavior had gotten out of hand. And above all else, what Dickinson College sought in its new president was someone who would rigorously enforce the law, because these students were obviously abusing the privileges and behaving in such a way that the trustees felt needed to be curbed. As they conducted this search, their eyes eventually fell upon a little college in the Champlain Valley of Vermont. And in due course, an offer of the presidency of this college was extended to none other than Jeremiah Atwater, who in fact had gained for himself during his 9 years at Middlebury quite a reputation as an enforcer of the rules. Just what the Dickinson College trustees ordered. And so President Atwater comes to Dickinson, and he does exactly what the trustees would have had him do. He says, the rules are the rules, and the rules apply here. And there are no exceptions. We are an arm of the rules, and you had better observe them. Within 3 years, there were practically no students left at Dickinson College. And President Atwater made a rather unceremonious, and one would also quite possibly say premature, exit from the presidency of the institution, where he had in fact carried out the bidding of those who hired him. This may or may not, as I say, have much to do with our discussion this evening, but it certainly helps to explain why it has taken almost 200 years for Dickinson College to invite another president of Middlebury to come to your campus. I come here not as an enforcer, but rather as someone who believes it's time to take a careful, informed, and dispassionate look at a vexatious issue of public policy. And I begin, perhaps rather curiously, with a visual. You may or may not know that this is an anniversary year. This is the 75th anniversary year of the repeal of Prohibition. 75 years ago, February 20th, Congress passed and sent to the states the language for what would become the 21st Amendment. Interesting that the two amendments in question are numbered 18 and 21. The 18th Amendment, of course, enacted Prohibition, and after about a dozen years of this noble experiment, the country had come to the conclusion that Prohibition simply wasn't working. Those who were choosing to drink were drinking more irresponsibly. Crime was on the increase. Disrespect for law was rampant. And instrumental in bringing about the repeal of Prohibition were mothers. And this poster from the Prohibition repeal movement is particularly instructive. Here's a mother with two young children about to vote to repeal Prohibition, the only time in the history of this country, by the way, where a constitutional amendment has ever been repealed. And it is precisely because of the corrosive, insidious, corruptive effect of this supposedly noble experiment that she believed their security, the security of her children, demanded repeal. And it's an interesting historical footnote, I think, that ultimately it was mothers who brought about the repeal of Prohibition. Now, 75 years later, we are being reminded again of the lessons and the consequences, both intended and unintended, of Prohibition. And we can call it what we will, but for 18, 19, and 20-year-olds, a law that says if you're under the age of 21, you may not drink, is only one thing, and that's Prohibition. Now, the origins of this law, as you probably know, date from 1984 and the passage of the National Minimum Legal Drinking Age Act of that year. That law, interestingly, did not set a national drinking age of 21. It did say, however, that the states who set the age lower than 21 will forfeit 10% of their federal highway funds. In Washington, inside the Beltway, this is called an incentive. Everywhere else, other terms come to mind. But not surprisingly, those states that still had ages lower than 21 quickly fell in line, and since 1986 or 7 or thereabouts, we have had the 21-year-old drinking age on the books in every state. And it's been on the books long enough for us to be able to gauge its consequences. Now, the principal reason for the passage of the law, and I think Mr. Hurley and I would certainly agree on this point, the motive was the problem of alcohol-related traffic fatalities. And to this quite serious and genuine public policy problem, a very, very blunt instrument was taken. And the argument was made that the best way to deal with the problem of alcohol-related traffic fatalities was to raise the drinking age. I think we need, as Al Smith, former governor of New York and erstwhile presidential candidate, once said, to look at the record. And we need to see how much, on those particular terms, this law has succeeded. Well, to begin with, we have a chart. These are not my opinions. These are national Highway Transportation and Safety Administration data, which show the downward trend over the last 25 years in the number of alcohol-related traffic fatalities. And the fact of the matter is they have gone down during that period of time. But the chart also shows that they started to go down in 1982. The chart also shows in the first 2 years after the law was changed, they went up. And the chart finally shows that in the year, most recent year for which we have data, they reached a 10-year high. So if we're going to talk about cause and effect, we need to talk about all of the causes and all of the effects, and not just those that support a particular side of the argument. Furthermore, if we look at the way this breaks down, what we discover is that that downward trend was not limited to 18 to 21-year-olds. The downward trend, in fact, occurred in every age group, and this breaks those numbers out by age. So the point is that drinking and driving and alcohol-related fatalities decline in every age group. Perhaps it's possible to argue that a 21-year-old drinking age is responsible for a reduction in the number of fatalities of 50-year-olds, but I'd like to meet the scientist who is able to demonstrate that to your or my satisfaction. It is entirely possible that the trend we see illustrated before us by National Highway Transportation and Safety Administration data has to do with a lot of factors besides the drinking age. It may have to do with safer automobiles. It may have to do with designated drivers. It may have to do with the remarkable success our friends at MAD have had in educating us about the perils of drinking and driving. What is unmistakably clear here, though, is that for a variety of reasons in every age group, those numbers have declined. Now, this slide is out of order, isn't it?
No.
Yes. Let's go to the next one.
Okay. You have about 1 minute.
Okay, thank you. This slide shows that seatbelts and safer automobiles have, in fact, had much more to do with the saving of lives by the drink than the drinking age has. These, again, are National Highway Transportation and Safety Administration data, which help illustrate the fact that safety, that the decline is attributable to a great many things. That's, therefore, how we might assess the question of the intended consequences. Let's look briefly at the unintended consequences, and they are many. Legal age 21 has very effectively banished drinking from public settings. Doesn't take place in bars, doesn't take place in restaurants, doesn't take place in large public gatherings. But as we all know, it's still taking place. Where is it taking place? It's taking place in those places where the law has banished it, behind closed doors, underground, off campus. And it's only been since 1991 that the term binge drinking has become a part of our vocabulary. And we see from the research done by Henry Wexler that binge drinking is a serious and growing problem. Now, I do believe there is something to be said for the fact that drinking that takes place in clandestine settings takes place in a more risky environment, and it's equally plausible to say that that environment has been created by a law that has simply uprooted and transplanted a problem and a practice from a public to a private venue. More to the point, lives lost to alcohol off the highways are no less precious than lives lost to alcohol on the highways. If our measurement of success is simply what takes place on the highways, we can claim, perhaps, a qualified success. But that is as if we were looking this way and paying no attention to what's going on over here. What's going on over here are practices that are placing young lives at risk in increasing numbers. And the research is very clear on this point. More than 1,000 lives each year are being lost by 18 to 24-year-olds to alcohol off the highways. That is another unintended consequence of this law. This law treats 18-year-olds who are in all other respects in the eyes of the law deemed to be adults as children. And it won't do to say in the condescending, patronizing way that is so often advanced that in this particular instance, in this alone, you lack judgment, you lack maturity. Even though our laws clearly say you can vote, you can serve on a jury, you can sign a contract, you can fight in the army, but you can't buy a beer. That anomaly needs to be explained. Sure. Our view, I think this is our last slide, our view is that it's time to revisit this law, its consequences, and consider changes. Our view is that Congress, when the reauthorization of the highway bill comes up next year, ought to be asked why the 10% incentive needs to be continued. If our friends are correct in saying that the public overwhelmingly supports 21, that incentive should be no longer necessary. And on the day after that incentive is removed, the age will still be 21 in every state. But this incentive has effectively stifled public debate at the level where the most creative thinking has always historically taken place, and that's on the state level. Remove that penalty and watch creative, imaginative thinking take place. And watch, as a result, public policy that more effectively reflects reality. That reality is that alcohol is a presence in the lives of 18, 19, and 20-year-olds. Either we can try to change the reality, that's called prohibition, or we can create a setting, we can create an environment that is more reflective of that reality and that reduces the risk to which young lives are being put.
That's a good place, I think, to stop.
There we go. I thank you, and I look forward to the rebuttal.
If I can load this up here. Put my glasses on. clicker? John, do you have the...
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. That's fine. Thanks.
I'm going to walk off with it.
Good evening. It is great to be back at Dickinson. My brother and I went here. Two sons of mine went here. Two daughters-in-law of mine went here. I was hoping to see Bill and ask for that tuition discount for a group purchase. This is a John and I actually agree on many points, disagree on others, but we share an agreement that drunk driving is serious business and has no place in any age group or on any highway. And we share a deep concern about the very dangerous levels of underage and binge drinking that seems prevalent. We disagree as to what the cause is, but we that's why we're here tonight. So I want to raise and answer several questions. One is, how did MAD come up with the 21 drinking age law? Well, the reality is we didn't. It was a presidential commission. President Reagan appointed a presidential commission on drunk driving in 1982, composed of current and future governors, medical people, car industry people, even members of the alcohol industry. And this is a quote from President Reagan. Where he cites the data that was presented, it forcefully recommended that all 50 states should be 21. MAD didn't invent that. We did help get it enacted. And obviously, 21 saves lives on the road. On the commission, the presidential commission, it was persuaded really by three key points. The first was the presentation by the Surgeon General of the United States at that time that every age group in America was increasing in longevity except one. And that was teenagers, and the leading cause of their death was drunk driving. The second was the issue, frankly and surprisingly, from the military. The leading cause of non-combat death in the military, believe it or not, is motor vehicle crashes. Caspar Weinberger, then Secretary of Defense, indicated that they were losing a battalion of troops every year to drunk driving, and he forcefully supported an increase in the drinking age. The third really is the uniformity issue, that states began increasing their drinking age back in 1975, and yet were penalized by blood borders on the states that refused to go, the best example being Illinois and Wisconsin. The border bars, Wisconsin wasn't about to go to 21, by the way. The border bars above Chicago and Wisconsin would have weekend specials trying to get the kids to come up from Chicago and try to make it back. So uniformity really was the issue. These are the studies that we still rely on. The 1,000 lives that John pointed out really is part of 5,000 total fatalities in the college age group of 18 to 24. 1,000, he's correct, are in fact non-traffic fatalities. Fully 79% of college age fatalities, alcohol-related, are motor vehicle fatalities. That's why we strongly support. I frankly don't expect to change many minds here tonight. I just really want to explain why MAD feels strongly about this and frankly why others feel strongly about this. The other studies, I think, indicate the same point. And it's one of the best public health laws, best studied public health laws in history. Fully 50 peer-reviewed studies. This isn't just our opinion and support of 21. It's also the Surgeon General of the United States, the President of the American Medical Association, the Chairman of the National Transportation Safety Board, the U.S. Secretary of Transportation, the President of the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety, the President of the National Safety Council, the Governor's Highway Safety Association, and a range of others. We follow the data, and that's unfortunately where it has led us. As it relates to fatalities off the road, we agree with John, we're equally concerned with that as well. There is some data, that is convincing data, that 21 has decreased consumption somewhat. Disappointingly, not very much, but somewhat. Also, there are clear indications of reductions and other harms, including suicide, homicide, and those are a major concern with lower drinking ages as well. Old enough to fight, old enough to drink. John and I were both proud to serve. Everybody that got out of school when we did had a job. Mine was in the Navy. I proudly served in the Far East as an intelligence officer during Vietnam. How many people here have served in the military? I was hoping for more. First off, thank you for your service. Second, I'm not sure whether being old enough to serve in the military but choosing not to entitles anyone to special privileges. Those who've served, and by the way, the Pentagon still supports 21. They do have provisions on bases that allow for service of alcohol to young soldiers when the commander finds that as appropriate for morale. But in fact, again, one of the strongest advocates for the drinking age in 1984 was the Pentagon. Forbidden fruit or college environment. I think John has raised the point, and I think others have. Is it the drinking age itself that is causing what we're both frightened about, the patterns of not only binge drinking, but extreme, dangerous, high-risk drinking? And the data, frankly, is fairly clear. If the drinking age makes this a forbidden fruit, we're not doing a real good job. It's cheap. It's widely available. Very little enforcement, very few consequences. I believe here at Dickinson, parents aren't notified until the second or third offense on alcohol-related violations. And as a result, 31% nationally of college students abuse, and 6% are dependent, according to Knight et al., much higher than similar non-college students. The drinking age, frankly, is working much better in blue-collar America than it is in Ivy League or college America. The SAMHSA agency of the Department of Health and Human Services, again, has found, again, the same factor. And this is not merely a failure of the 21 law, but also a direct outcome of the college environment. Again, not easy. I think John agrees. Their college presidents were put in a very tough position on this. They could do one of two things. They could either turn a blind eye and pretend they weren't seeing what was happening, or they could become part of the enforcement of a tough law. Neither is what I think they signed up to do. It's a very tough issue, but the easy button of just passing a law to reduce the drinking age to 18-year-olds, in the view of the data, would transfer that very tough problem to high school principals, something they're not really wild about receiving. Why can't we do it like Europe? John and others have often raised this issue. The answer is we could. And this is what the data looks like, not our data, but the Institute of Medicine, which I think everybody agrees is one of the best sources of public health data in the world. And you can see, with the norm being the U.S. on the right, that actually some countries in Europe do have lower rates of adolescent intoxication than we do. France, for example, does. I think Italy does. But look at the rest. Britain, Ireland, Northern Europe, Eastern Europe. Very disturbing rates of binge and underage drinking. The fact is, underage and binge drinking are problems in every country in the world. They have different drinking ages all over the world. We happen to have one of the highest. But the drinking age, I think, seems to be less of a factor than the underlying cultural experiences. And even in those countries like France, for example, that have initially lower rates of adolescent intoxication, France has one of the highest cirrhosis rates in the world. These are tough problems, and the easy button of just reducing the drinking age, frankly, is not supported in any data that MAD knows. But at MAD, we really don't decide this entirely on data. This is a picture of Jonathan Levy. Jonathan Levy was a 20-year-old student at Radford University in Virginia, was drinking with two other friends. Got in a car with a driver who was extremely drunk, hit a new professor head-on, a mother of five kids, killed instantly. The driver died. Jonathan died. The other backseat passenger just got out of rehab a year or two ago, lost an eye, lost part of a foot, has very serious traumatic brain injury. This is the cost of underage and binge drinking, and unfortunately, Jonathan's father is here with us tonight, Jeff Levy, who knows this price very well. That's who we represent. That is why we feel strongly about this and really feel that anything that reduces our definition of is it working, does it work, our definition is family funerals. 21 has been demonstrated not by our opinion, but by all of the authorities I've mentioned before, to have reduced family funerals in the United States since 1984 by 25,000. 25,000 fewer underage fatalities. That's why we feel so strongly about it. So is college making been shrinking in Evel? Well, the good news is it's not. We are beginning a study, frankly, of some of the campuses that have had great success in reducing binge drinking and underage drinking. Most people look to University of Nebraska, Washington State University, the California State System, Penn State, University of Rhode Island, and others. We really want to take a look at what's working on other campuses and look forward, actually, to discussing this further with John. But obviously, it does involve more consistent enforcement, better control of access, greater understanding of the impacts, getting parents involved. Trying to solve this problem at the college level is way too late. We believe that this needs to begin with parents at much earlier ages, perhaps parents of about fourth graders. And we're not exaggerating there. And really building a better culture for our kids are being raised in a corrosive environment as it relates to alcohol and other dangerous drugs. But if you combine every other dangerous drug, cocaine, heroin, meth, crack, all of them, combined, it doesn't reach the number of those kids killed by alcohol.
Sure.
Again, our website, mad.org, for more information. We believe the inconvenient truth is that 21 has saved lives. I'm not sure it has magically reduced underage drinking. We wish it had. But we believe that that it has saved lives on the highway. There is no easy button for the problems, and that which is right is seldom easy. And that which is easy is seldom right. Thank you.
Professor McArdle will now have 3 minutes of rebuttal time.
Three minutes, even less time than eight, and so I look forward to the questions and a chance to elaborate somewhat more fully on the points that need to be more fully developed. But very, very briefly, let me speak to several of the things Mr. Hurley has said and elaborate on several points that I made earlier. The first is that most of the rest of the world has, in fact, come to a very different conclusion and position on the question of the drinking age than has the United States. In fact, only three other countries in the world have a drinking age as high as 21. And those other pace setters are Indonesia, Mongolia, and Palau. I see no evidence of massive alcohol problems. I see no evidence of widespread brain impairment. I see very little evidence to suggest that the particular wisdom and insight that we claim to possess by virtue of having a higher drinking age is borne out by any conspicuous successes on our part. In fact, what we see in this country is a remarkable absence of alcohol education, and a part of what we are proposing is that alcohol education be made mandatory and that alcohol education cease to be what it all too often is, which is temperance lectures and scare tactics. You know as well as I do that an education program that tells you if you touch a drop of alcohol, you're destined for a life of dependency and depravity, that if you touch a drop of alcohol, you're going to fry your brain, is simply not true and is not based on any sort of reliable or significant scientific data. But that too often is what passes for alcohol education. We need a much more comprehensive and mandatory program of alcohol education, which would result in the licensing of 18-year-olds to make responsible decisions about alcohol. Imagine, if you would, saying to a driver who has reached driving age, here are the keys. There's the car. Good luck. You figure it out. I, as a parent, would love to sit there in the front seat with you, but my state will forfeit 10% of its federal highway funds if I do. Fact of the matter is that in a great many states, parents who seek to educate their sons and daughters about alcohol in the privacy of their own home, and Pennsylvania is one, Vermont is another, break the law. This law marginalizes parents, and it forces parents to abdicate one of their most solemn responsibilities. Where ought that education to take place? This law prohibits that. Doesn't make it optional, and those who choose to violate it say to their sons and daughters, it's okay to break the laws we disagree with. That's irresponsible parenting. It's irresponsible academic leadership, but it is what the current law has forced upon us. The age of 21 assumes that most young people and their families, most of the time, left on their own, cannot be trusted to act responsibly. Age 18 assumes that most young people and their families, most of the time left on their own, can be counted upon to behave responsibly. That's really what this debate comes down to, and I look forward to expanding upon those and other of your thoughts as we continue in the discussion and the questions and answers. Thanks.
I think I'm going to be even shorter because I think both John and I are looking forward to the questions. In fact, this underage and binge drinking is a problem in every nation in the world. It's handled differently. Drinking ages are different. But we, frankly, are the only nation in the world that gives unlimited access to motor vehicles at age 16. Does that complicate the problem? Yes, it does. It's the combination of driving and drinking is, in fact, what led to the drinking age. But as it relates to brain development, we do have another expert here in the audience, Dr. Bryce Templeton, a psychiatrist and physician at Drexel, who unfortunately also is an involuntary member of Matt's family, lost his son a week or so before he was to become an MD. If anybody wants to talk about brain development, the fact is the data is not conclusive yet, but it clearly indicates that drinking onset, chronic drinking onset at 15 leads to a 5-time risk of alcohol dependency later on. That's not Mad's opinion. That's what the literature says. The family-friendly issue is a tough one. We're not sure that it's family-friendly, frankly, for the government to give drinking licenses to 18-year-olds with or without their parents' permission. We don't consider that to be family-friendly at Mad. We do think and agree with John that the responsibility occurs much sooner and that parents should take this issue sooner, beginning talking with their kids at much lower. By the time it's college age, kids have been in drinking education for about 18 years. They've seen what their parents do. They've seen what the community does. They have generally gotten the message on drunk driving, thankfully, not entirely. 60% of fatal injuries in teenage motor vehicle crashes before the drinking age were alcohol-related. It's only 30% now, so we have made progress. But again, our definition of is it working is the reduction by 25,000 of family funerals to those underage caused by drinking and driving, and that is persuasive to us. We look forward to your questions. Thank you.
If you have a question, please raise your hand, and someone will find you with a microphone.
Hi, first off, my name is Eli Brill, and I'm a sophomore here, and thank you very much for both of you coming. I think it's a great service to everyone. My question, first off, is, Mr. Hurley, you didn't discuss the statistic that President Cardle brought forward, that the drop in fatalities when the law was passed was not simply in 18 to 21-year-olds, but the entire age group. And I'm curious on your opinions on that.
Sure.
And the second one is, neither of you discussed the mental implications in 18-year-olds. You mentioned 15-year-olds and the change that could have versus 21-year-olds, but I'm curious the 18-year-old brain versus the 21-year-old brain and the different effects it would have on that. Thank you.
I guess I'd start and then go to John. I don't know of data on 18-year-old brains. The data that I cited was what we know. But the fact is we do know that brains continue to develop until about age 25. That's why insurers charge you more, that there is risk-taking behavior, particularly in young males. Back on the issue of the data, and I'm glad you asked, John's presentation indicated that the drop of all age groups had flattened out, and of course he's correct about that, about 10 years ago. But the drop in the drinking age, and I've spent 30 years working on things like seatbelts and airbags, is unrelated to seatbelts and airbags. It literally is related to the drinking age, about 900 lives a year. And presenting data on all age groups is misleading. It's true about all age groups. When you isolate the drinking age, which is what the Surgeon General has done, what the American Medical Association has done, what the National Transportation Safety Board, and I could go on, has done, the inconvenient truth is that 21 has saved lives. And I think John would, I'm not sure he would agree, but I would let him respond to that. But there is no controversy whatsoever in the science. 50 peer-reviewed studies. There's little controversy in the public, about 70% regularly reported support. No controversy whatsoever in the Congress. There's controversy in two places, on college campuses, surprise, and sporadically in the media, which sells controversy for a license, for their living. So I would be glad to talk with you further about the data, and the data is what it is. It's very strong in support of the drinking age.
The chart that I showed were not numbers I made up.
Correct.
Those are NHTSA numbers that show the number of lives saved. That 1,000 is derived by applying a 0.13 to a particular number. It's an exercise in statistics and probability and abstraction. We can agree or disagree with that methodology, but that's how that number is arrived at. The number of lives saved by seatbelts and airbags is arrived at in a similar way. But the fact of the matter is that those data unmistakably show that safer automobiles and safety restraints have saved many, 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 many multiples of the lives that legal age 21 has saved. And 75% of those who die in traffic accidents that are alcohol-related aren't wearing seatbelts. Those are also NHTSA data. Now, you also asked about the brain. Well, first of all, one more point about these peer-reviewed studies. Now, this point has been made twice, and it is absolutely true that there are 50 peer-reviewed studies that show a positive relationship between legal age 21 and a decline in fatalities. But the rest of that sentence should include the fact that that's out of a total of 102 studies, the other half of which show no relationship between those two, and that's in the same Wagoner article that that 50 comes from. So it's hard to argue on that basis that science is overwhelmingly or on one side of this question. Now, on the issue of brain development, very quickly, Dr. Scott Swartwelder, who is a leading authority on this subject, is a member of the board of Choose Responsibility. He's a very distinguished physician at the Duke University Medical School. He has demonstrated through his research that the brain of an adolescent rat reaches full development at the approximate human age of 25. He goes on to argue that if there are public policy implications of these findings, we should raise the drinking age to 25. Nobody's arguing that. Furthermore, note that whenever the relationship between alcohol use and brain development gets mentioned, we're talking about excessive use, chronic use. Of course, excessive use of alcohol doesn't stop being a threat to you when you turn 25, but moderate use, occasional use. Nowhere in the science will you find a respectable science asserting that there is a measurable, significant difference in adolescent brain development at age 18 or 21. Yes at 12, yes at 14, yes at 15. And finally, if you're really worried about brain development, folks, do something about the environment in which those brains are being put at risk, which are the dark closets, the dark corners where binge drinking is taking place.
Hi. I actually have several questions, but I'll just say the one that's most important to me. I was wondering if, Mr. McArdle, you could respond to implications for high school principals, which Mr. Hurley brought up, because I feel like that's a really important point in terms of it would be much easier for high school students, much younger than the age of 18, to obtain alcohol if they had friends that were seniors and were 18. I do realize that there would be this education that you're suggesting, but is that really going to have as much of an effect if there's that sort of peer pressure for drinking?
Well, with all due respect, I would say that that assertion is simply that. We can hypothesize about what the effects on high schools might be, but the fact is that's about all we can do. What we do know is that when the age went from 18 to 21, the age of onset did not go up. One might have expected, if your hypothesis is correct, that raising the age by 3 years would raise the age of onset. It didn't. It's still right around 13. It may very well be, in other words, that this question of alcohol use by middle and high school students has very little to do with a drinking age and much more to do with the presence or absence of education that these young people are receiving. I certainly wouldn't want to argue that the status quo should be satisfying to anybody. And yet, keep in mind that each time the current state of the alcohol culture is being described, that is what has existed for the last 24 years under legal age 21. And so it seems to me at least some of the burden of proof in making these assertions, and that's all they are, is to explain to us how legal age 21 has made a significant inroads in the problem of underage drinking at the present time. I don't see much evidence of that.
I'll try to keep my answer short. The data we presented from countries around the world that have lower drinking ages does indicate a higher rate of intoxication among adolescents. I agree with John. The current state is not ideal. We're not. No one's arguing that the binge drinking we see and hear about is ideal. But there is evidence to indicate that when there's unlimited access at 18, in fairness to John, it's for high school graduates. But if you license 18-year-olds, I'm sure there won't be any fake ID in that area either. And I'm sure there won't be any purchase of alcohol. I'm being a little facetious. I really am genuinely concerned that licensing at 18 would provide increased availability to those in high schools.
Hello, my name is Andy McDonald. I'm a professor of French here at Dickinson College. I'd like to direct my question to Mr. Hurley. You mentioned that blue-collar groups seem to have been more affected by the 21 rule, and college campuses remain strangely immune to a reduction in drinking on campus. Is that correct?
That's what we see the data says, yes.
So what I'm interested about that, I'm interested in what the implications of that are, what it says about what we're doing or not doing on college campuses as educators, and also perhaps even legally speaking, the ways in which college security forces relate to municipal police, for example, and the way in which laws are applied to students or applied to town members who are not students, for example, and how that works out. It's a troubling question to me.
I'm not sure there's simple answers, but the data does indicate that the binge and underage drinking extremes are more present on college campuses than off college campuses. It may have something to do with the discipline of having to get up for work in the morning, but I don't know that there's perfect data on that. It does seem that on college campuses where young people outnumber adults by 7-10 to 1, and where often young people are away from their families for the first time, where they have almost unlimited access to money, unlimited access to alcohol, and time on their hands, it creates, by the way, there are lots of other great things about Dickinson and college campuses, but it can be, as it relates to alcohol, a very toxic situation, and the data speak for themselves.
Good evening. My name is Veronica Balin. I'm the parent of two 20-somethings. And first of all, I don't think some parents are quite fit to instruct their children in drinking alcohol. I also appreciate the data about the drunk driving. We're here with MAD and Choose Responsibility. There's no sense in making a law that cannot be enforced. And why aren't we all moving forward and using our money and our lobbyists, going to the automobile manufacturers and putting in a device that doesn't let anybody drink and drive? It's a problem across the board, not just for kids. I also think that the drinking age should be lowered to 18.
On the first half, I thought she was a plant of mine, but the second half... This is something, actually, the first part is what I think John and I agree on. You'll be pleased to know that MAD is actively working with car makers around the world. The car makers believe they can produce new vehicles in about 10 years that simply won't be operable by drunk drivers. Breakthroughs in cars can park themselves these days, lane departure warnings and the rest. Have the honor of going to Japan in about 2 weeks to speak before the Diet, Ministry of Transport, and the American Embassy is shipping around it. There really is a real possibility that in 10 years, new cars can be equipped with advanced technology, and people haven't been convicted of drunk driving, shouldn't have to blow anything, probably shouldn't have to pay for anything, with reductions in their insurance premiums. MAD is, go to our website at mad.org and our campaign to eliminate drunk driving, I think you'll be pleased by that because, and the car makers are not fighting this. They are supporting that effort. John and I think, agree on this point. Obviously, your views on 21 we respect, but we do support the 21 drinking age.
Choose Responsibility, by the way, does support the notion of the ignition interlock because we think that it is precisely not like the blunt instrument that has been taken to the problem of drunken driving. We can either stigmatize and discriminate against an entire category of the population simply on the basis of age, or we can address the problem where it exists and require offenders to install the ignition interlock after they have committed a DUI offense. That strikes me as appropriate, as surgical, and as dealing with the problems and the sources of the problems, and goes in exactly the opposite direction of stigmatizing an entire generation and assuming that entire generation is going to behave irresponsibly.
One thing I would add is, you know, the main reason why people continue to drive drunk 28 years after everybody knows what it does, that it kills families, it kills kids, it kills cops. Main reason why people continue to drive drunk is because they can. We have enough officers to catch one out of 87 drunk drivers once they get on the road. And current technology interlocks should be applied to all convicted drunk drivers. And advanced technology interlocks, which are pretty exciting technology, we're very hopeful would current technology interlocks on all drunk drivers would save 4,000 lives a year. Advanced technology has the potential of saving more than 9,000 lives a year. So that we are spending, frankly, more time on that than we are on the drinking age.
I'm Robert Marriott. I'm a junior here. My question is directed to both of you, I suppose. It occurs to me that one difference between the United States and many other nations, though those nations are catching up with the United States over time, is the degree to which alcohol, and particularly hard liquors, aside from beers, are marketed both to use in some sense, but in generally as a means towards things such as entertainment or sex or social status, something which I think has also greatly accelerated in the time since the creation of the 21 law. I was curious as to how either of you thought that this might interact with the arguments that you've already described.
Glenn.
Well, first off, MAD doesn't make a distinction between a 12-ounce beer, a 5-ounce wine, or an ounce and a half of alcohol. It's the same. Frankly, the medium of alcohol doesn't make much difference to us, and generally the choice of most young people, or many young people, is beer. Beer a can of beer, a drink of wine, and a shot of distilled spirits has the same effect. As it relates to the culture, this is a very tough issue that I think we both are pretty much in agreement on, that actually we're raising our kids in a corrosive environment. Half of Hollywood should be on an interlock. A percentage of major league athletes are on steroids. Something disturbing is going on in society that not only tolerates but seems to celebrate abuse. And that's going to take all of us working together, I think, to address, and beginning at much earlier ages than either 21 or 18.
I will confess myself to harboring some skepticism about the degree to which reducing or eliminating certain kinds of advertising can be expected to have a significant effect. The more often we tell you you can't do something, it is entirely possible that the more likely it is you'll choose to do it. Once again, it seems to me that education offers a much more promising avenue. If we're successful in what we do at places like Dickinson College, we're teaching you to develop a critical sensibility so that when you see a text, whether that text is a novel or a musical score or an advertisement on television, you're able to view that critically and dispassionately and make a judgment. I think that it's far better to expect human beings to develop that intelligence and to make those individual judgments, that's what our society is predicated on, than having law after law after law telling you what you can't do because of our concern that one or two of you might do something we would disapprove of.
We have time for one more question. Well, Hallie, how long do we have? Oh, yeah, we've got time for lots more questions.
Good, good. Great.
Hi, I'm Lee Tank. I'm a sophomore. I'm not sure if you guys have any data or opinion about this, but something I always think about.
At least we have opinions, I'm sure.
with underage drinking, with the current drinking age of 21 right now, at least for college students, what role does the thrill of doing something illegal play, and probably being able to get away with it, play in the underage drinking and binge drinking problem?
I think that's a question that's more appropriately directed at you than at us. But let me pair your question with a question. How many people in this room, whatever your age and whatever your alma mater, sampled alcohol before you were of legal drinking age? Be honest. We won't take names.
Yeah, that's virtually everybody.
All right. I ask you whether I'm not sure what this proves, and I'm not sure whether this answers your question, but the one thing I think it pretty clearly demonstrates is that a law that says you mustn't drink until you reach legal drinking age, on its own terms, in the most basic of senses, isn't working. How can we say the law is working based on what we've just seen?
Well, I don't think it is working in terms of eliminating underage drinking. I think it is working in reducing 25,000 funerals of underage people since 1984. Again, not our opinion, the data from the Surgeon General and others that we indicated. The drinking age in Pennsylvania has been 21 for 75 years. Whatever is happening on our campuses, the drinking age hasn't changed in Pennsylvania. By the way, there was binge drinking. And I think John and I would agree that Washington and Lee in the 60s and in Dickinson, binge drinking was still there. It does seem to be getting worse in part. The idea of identifying the cause that it's getting worse is because of laws that were passed beginning in 1975 is something we don't have data to support. And if it is the forbidden fruit issue, as I indicated, we're not doing a very good job of forbidding it. It is available very easily.
I'd prefer to do the questions.
At the end. Get to 8:30.
Okay. Yeah. Just continue the questions as long as.
Hi, my name is Alex Bloom. I'm a freshman here at Dickinson. Thanks for coming, as everyone else has said. It seems that you guys both focus a lot on education and the impact that that has on drinking as opposed to the law. I mean, both of you seem to be in agreement that education can have a far more reaching impact.
No? We'll get to
okay.
that.
Okay. Well, the positions that you are in would indicate that you have both had some type of education in alcohol that has created for you the ability to drink responsibly. Perhaps you could each talk about your own personal education in this regard and how you've come to the point where you are.
Do you want?
Sure. The term binge drinking, in fact, did not enter our vocabulary, as I said earlier, until the 1990s. To say that behavior that might or might not be defined as binge drinking was present before that is, of course, distinctly possible. But as a research question and as a matter of public policy, it was only in 1991 that became so identified. I think that the circumstances way back in the dark ages when we were in school were very different in a great many ways. In the state of Virginia, for example, one could purchase 3-2 beer and wine, but one couldn't purchase hard liquor. Federalism, in fact, worked pretty well, and even more to the point, because of the way in which the laws were framed and enforced, there was very little clandestineness to that sort of behavior. It was out in the open. And one didn't get in a car and drive off to some farmer's field and do shots. Were we perfect? No. Did we occasionally overdo it? Yes. But we put ourselves at far, far less risk in those circumstances, then your generation is being put at. And I know all about pre-gaming. I know all about pre-loading. I know about shots, Beirut, all of those games. And those aren't taking place out in the open. And you need to tell me why they're not taking place out in the open if there's some explanation other than the law. I think our experience was in a very different generation. It may or may not be germane to your circumstances, but what I can say is that it was much more out in the open and in public view than it is now. My view is that out in the open and in public is generally better than behind closed doors and clandestine.
I had an interesting education here at Dickinson in drinking. Among other things, I bartended my way through school. I attended bar at the Walnut Bottom Tavern. Anybody old enough to remember the Walnut Bottom Tavern and Frick's? And John talks about public, you know, the being the responsibility in public service. The only supervision I remember applying as a bartender was, would you like another? Related to, we do support education. We do a lot of it. But education alone, unfortunately, is not effective in reducing drunk driving. And let me really state a couple of things. Drunk driving is a really easy crime to commit. Last time I checked, most bars had parking lots. It's a really hard crime to catch. We have enough officers to catch one out of 87 drunk drivers once they get on the road. It's kind of a hide-and-seek program. And the equilibrium we've had in the last 10 years is what has driven us to look at technology and ways to reduce that. Once stopped, it's a really hard crime to convict, and we have the defense bar to thank for that, who sit on many of the judiciary committees and legislatures around the country. And once convicted, we know that up to 80% of drunk drivers continue to drink and drive, again, because we can. Back to the issue of technology. So that what we have, MAD is one of the few organizations that can say with, and it wasn't just us, it was with a lot of supporters, that we have solved 44% of the problem that we were organized to address. A lot of people give credit to MAD. We really give credit to law enforcement. The main, we believe that probably one of the most educational things is the arrest of drunk drivers. That's educational. So that if it were education alone that were effective, none of us would be here. The problem would have been solved. We've been educating about drunk driving and underage drinking for decades. The main reason why people drive drunk, the main reason why people drink underage is because they can. And I think we need to collectively address the cultures that tolerate and support that.
I have actually two questions, and one of them, I guess I'm asking more because I think it needs to be explored than out of personal conviction. That's a caveat at the outset. And that is what I guess you might call the libertarian argument. I mean, there are a number of policies that we could introduce in this country that would speak to the issue of saving lives. We could change laws on access to guns. We could change laws on access to cigarettes. We could lower speed limits from 65 to 55 or 45, and we don't. Because the notion is that saving lives, important though it is, has to be balanced against personal liberty. And I'm curious, you know, how both of you would address that issue. The second one is something that it is something I worry about a lot as a college administrator, and that is we're placed in a situation by the law in which on the one extreme we can, as a couple of people have suggested, just ignore what goes on our campuses, act as if it doesn't occur, in which case we are behaving in a way that's not only illegal, but probably irresponsible. On the other end of the spectrum, we can engage in real enforcement on our campuses and prohibit, in which case I would argue we will significantly impair our ability to be educators with our students because we have to adopt a role that's more appropriately carried out by police. So I'd be curious to get both of your sense about where, given the current circumstance, one way or the other, college policy ought to fall, how we ought to handle this dilemma.
I could not improve upon the language of your second point except to say that college campuses are currently places where two separate sets of laws apply, and you don't know simply by looking at them which set applies to which people. Try running a city, try running a county, try running a state under those circumstances, and you will come more fully to appreciate the dilemma, the genuine dilemma you've just described. To your first point, I would simply say that this balance between freedom and security, to put it a different way, is a constant throughout our history. But I think we have learned throughout that history repeatedly and not necessarily to our edification that prohibition doesn't work. We tried it in the 1850s. It didn't work. We tried it in the 1920s. It didn't work. To 18, 19, and 20-year-olds, the current law looks an awful lot like prohibition, and it isn't working. How many times do we need to relearn that lesson?
It's a tough question. I would point out that John's for prohibition at 18, we're for prohibition at 21. I'm not sure either one of us is a libertarian on that issue, on that basis. But I'm going to guess that most of the students here would support a lower drinking age. Would they support that if they knew that that would be 900 additional fatalities a year, which is what the Surgeon General and all the other groups have indicated? It is a balance. I can tell you at MAD, we clearly understandably speak for the people who've lost that lottery. It's essentially like a game of Russian roulette with a bullet cylinder. Most times the consequences aren't that bad. Sometimes they're real bad. So that's why we have elected officials. And when something works, 21 has done a better job of reducing fatalities on the highway, somewhat reduced consumption, somewhat reduced binge drinking, not recently. We are very reluctant to give up those 900 lives a year, and that's who we are.
Hi, my name is Darcy Phillips, and I'm a freshman here, and my question's for Mr. Hurley. You mentioned earlier in your presentation that on some military bases, those who are under 21 are permitted to drink if it's deemed necessary for their morale. And I was wondering how that's acceptable in that scenario, and therefore what message does that send about following the law?
Good question. I'm not sure what I'm supposed to say. I'm getting all the first questions. I won't go there. No. It's a very good question. The military is in 68% of the Marine Corps, by the way, is under age 26. They can't get people our age to charge hills. Very tough problem. But under military rules, they do allow for some underage drinking when a unit comes back from Iraq. I think the Marine Corps does it particularly during the Marine Corps birthday. It is under the very careful guidance of a gunny sergeant. And by the way, it doesn't occur very often. We don't second guess what the military does. Matter of fact, MAD works with the military, all services on bases across America and around the world. We are often called upon to help. But the difference between colleges and the military may be that gunny sergeant.
Thank you both for being here. I had a question for Mr. McArdle. Professor McArdle, my brother actually goes to Middlebury, so I'm sort of familiar with the drinking policies there, having visited him a few times. how did that come out completely? Not how I meant it.
I'm no longer president.
Regardless, Middlebury, like Dickinson, has policies that are quite different than the towns that we reside in, and much different policies in terms of getting caught if you're underage or sort of the relationship that the college has. I mean, I know that Carlisle, for example, doesn't have a safe ride program. I know Middlebury, has a safe ride program for its students, that sort of thing. I'm sort of interested in Middlebury's specific experience in having a different set of laws than the town and developing that, and what tensions maybe that has with the town and things like that. So thank you.
That's a great question. And in a sense, it takes us back to the earlier observation about the impossible dilemma that college presidents face and that parents face about being arms of the law or havens from the law, neither of which is tenable. What most of us do is try to work out a graded system of penalties that start with a citation and that if the offenses are frequent or severe, ultimately leads to suspension or expulsion. That's an imperfect way of dealing with the reality, but it is also an acknowledgement of what the reality is. What you discover when you go onto campuses, though, is that there are two very, very different conflicting approaches to how to deal with the presence of alcohol on campus. There are those who believe in abstinence, and there are those who believe in harm reduction. and there is a chasm that separates them. The abstinence people, I think, probably feel very virtuous in declaring their campuses dry and in believing, probably honestly, that they've really solved the problem and eradicated it, and they probably have, at least within their own eyesight and purview. But they deceive themselves if they think they have solved the problem in any sort of significant way. They simply put it out of sight. The harm reduction people, on the other hand, acknowledge the reality that exists in the lives of 18 to 20-year-olds and take the position that the proper policy is to minimize the harm that these young people will cause to themselves or to others. But you get the two in the same room, and they talk past each other. They say things like, safe ride program, you support a safe ride program, you're an enabler. That's the kind of stuff you have to deal with. And I grow impatient, I'll confess, did and do, with that kind of argument, because the abstinence side simply lives in a world of unreality.
This will be our last question.
Pretty tough question. I'm not sure the issue is hopeless on college campuses. We are very we keep hearing great things about University of Nebraska. I may mention University of Nebraska, Washington State University, Cal State System, Penn State, Rhode Island, others. Not easy. But they've made important reductions in underage and binge drinking. I would again point out that I don't know of any country in the world or any college in the world that's eliminated underage drinking. If there is, we would love to go see it. But it has definitely saved lives, mainly on the highway. We find that convincing. Pressing the easy button and just saying, well, the solution is just to lower the drinking age, there's not a shred of science that we've seen that supports that, and we believe it would pass that problem on to high schools.
Do we have time for one more? Okay, one last question.
Thank you guys for being here tonight. My name is Chris Pillion. I am a sophomore at Camp Hill High School. I'm here tonight with the Cumberland County Youth Advisory Board for the Drug and Alcohol Commission. And my question to both of you, and I want your personal opinion on this, not necessarily something based on the statistics and the facts. The middle school and the high school youth, the people in that age range and in those grades, say if the drinking age was lowered to 18, what do you personally think their reaction to that would be? Do you think, like, some people think, like, oh, they'd just go crazy, they'd just start drinking like crazy? Or do you think there would be sort of like a gradual moderation? I just want your personal opinion. Thank you.
Well, if we believe that all we were to do was to lower the age to 18, I think we would be setting ourselves up for some of the problems that have been hypothesized earlier. But I think if we were to educate and to license, we would, and to say that if you violate the laws of the state before you turn 18, you forfeit your eligibility for the license. If you violate the laws after you turn 18, you give up that license immediately, we might suddenly create an incentive that would lead to better behavior and a willingness to defer the gratification until one reached the age of legal adulthood. So I like to think that in the presence of education and in view of an incentive, we might have much, much less to fear and maybe even something to hope for if the age is lowered to 18 in combination with serious education, serious licensing, and serious enforcement, none of which we have now.
Well, first off, thank you for coming for the and bringing your friends with you. I'm not sure there's one answer to that. I think there'd be a range of behaviors. I think many of them are very responsible. A lot of it may have to do with what kind of family structure they had and parenting they had. A lot of it may have to do with what peer group they have. I'm not sure there's a single answer. But does the data indicate it would increase the number of fatalities on the road and possibly in binge drinking? Unfortunately, the inconvenient truth is that it does.
Let's thank Mr. Hurley and Professor McArdle one more time.
On behalf of Dickinson College and the Clark Forum, I would like to thank our panelists and moderator. I present them with a token of our appreciation.
Ah, poof, look at this.
At this time, I would like to remind you of the informal discussion taking place in HAPSCI rooms 202 and 203. Also, please remember to place the ballots in the boxes located at the doors on your way out of the social hall. This concludes tonight's program. Thank you for coming and have a good evening.